Monday, it's a new episode of All Rise, the legal drama where one judge is shaking up the system.
When I take the bench, I'm taking a vow to fight for justice.
One case at a time.
Your Honor,
we're going to trial.
Simone Missick is Judge Lola Carmichael.
Up on that bench. Everything is different.
A new episode of All Rise.
Freedom is at stake.
It's important.
Followed by a new episode of Bull, Monday at 9, 8 central on CBS.
Hackers are after your business data. I can help. I am Vi, the virtual intelligence assistant at Virtual Armor.
Virtual Armor, partnered with Juniper Networks, provides cybersecurity services and end-to-end solutions to keep what's yours, yours. Defend yourself with managed firewall and managed SIM essential core services that are economical and efficient. Virtual Armor goes beyond just initial alerting to provide a thorough report on threats, vulnerabilities, and results.
Let me help protect you. Contact me at justaskvi. That's vi.com.
Well, hello, Carolinas. You're listening to Carolina Focus on News Talk 1110, 99.3 WBT, 107.9 The Link, and 102.5 610 Sports Radio FNZ. It's also available as a podcast on WBT.com. We're your co-hosts. I'm Ed Billick, along with Sharon Thorsland. And now let's get started. A great interview and very timely. Sharon's going to kick us off with a discussion on the March of Dimes.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Carolina Focus. I am Sharon Thorsland. We have some really special guests on today talking about a subject that is really near and dear to my heart. I'm sure that a lot of our regular listeners know that I have a set of twins who were born premature, and I have been working with the March of Dimes for, gosh, over 10, 12 years now. So the March of Dimes has a really, really neat event coming up here later this month, and we want to highlight that today as well as the work that they are doing. So joining me now, we have Jamie Gensheimer. She is a development manager for the Greater Charlotte Hickory Area March of Dimes, and also Pat Campbell. She is the vice president of the Women's and Children's Institute for Novant Health here in Charlotte, and she is also the chair of the Greater Charlotte Hickory Area March of Dimes chapter. Thanks both of you guys for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Well, Jamie, I want to start with you. If you could give us sort of an overview of what the March of Dimes does, particularly here in the Charlotte area.
Sure. So March of Dimes is a national organization, and we fight for the health of all moms and babies. And the way that we do that is we do that through research, advocacy, and education programming. And here in the Charlotte area, we've just actually recently launched a supportive pregnancy program that we've partnered with Novant that we have, and it's for women of the same gestational age to get together. And what we've seen is that when you put those women together, they go to the fuller term. So we're really excited to see that on the ground here in Charlotte. And then we've also, during this pandemic, we've provided masks for families who are leaving the hospital. And we've amped up our virtual platforms for people to access the information that they need while they're in the hospital.
Well, Pat, I know that in your role at Novant, you obviously see the effects of prematurity on a regular basis. And you know, I'm sure, what the March of Dimes has done to help those babies as well as their moms and families. Can you tell us a little bit about the March of Dimes and its impact in everything that you do on a regular basis and here in Charlotte?
Sure. And I do want to say also thank you for having us, Sharon. You know, anytime I get a chance to talk about the March of Dimes, I'm there. Because I have seen firsthand, you know, what the March of Dimes does, not only nationally, but locally. Novant Health has been involved with the March of Dimes now. When you were saying 10 to 12 years, I think ours really backs up to 15, 16 years, where we have been sponsors of the two major events for the March of Dimes, the March for Babies and the Chef's event. And it truly, I think, for Novant Health, we see what the March of Dimes does on a daily basis. And I'll really focus with our neonatal intensive care nursery. You know, that unit is amazing. And when you look at the babies in there and think about, okay, all of the respiratory conditions with prematurity, because unfortunately that is usually an outcome. And to think about all the research, the therapeutics that the March of Dimes has really been responsible for. And, you know, looking to not only research what can be done, but to really bring those products to the intensive care nurseries. So it's easy for us because the March of Dimes, with the mission to really improve the health of moms and babies, that's the mission of Novant Health with our institute. So the two go hand in hand. And, you know, it's not just a sponsorship. When I think about what our commitment is, it's, you know, our nursing team, our providers, our administration, I will even say, you know, that really want to partner and see this as just a natural going forward. And so it's also amazing when you think about what the March of Dimes has done during the COVID period. Mm-hmm. You know, I thought, okay, well, you know, so much of our world has been at a standstill or adapting to a new normal. And that's what the March of Dimes has done. Jamie mentioned the supportive pregnancy, you know, to put that on a platform where it can be virtual, you know, for our pregnant moms and families. I mean, that's amazing. Another example is just putting information out there about COVID and the impact while, you know, research is still being done and data being collected. You know, what is the impact for moms and babies with COVID? And so that's been a great resource for Novant Health in what we're collecting on a day-to-day basis of what we're seeing with COVID, and then using the literature and information that's, you know, that's out there from the March of Dimes to put into best practice what we do to care for those moms and babies on a day-to-day basis. The other thing I was thinking about, and I used this in a report that I gave yesterday, the March of Dimes has done projections in terms of what is COVID, what impact is COVID going to have on pregnancies and births and premature births maybe in the next year and a half. And so we use those numbers of those projections. It was like 500,000 individual births that we probably will not see compared to 2019. Wow. Because of COVID and really? Of course, all the reasons behind it. So that impacts wow. us as leaders to project and know, you know, what the future holds. So I could go on and on, but the March of Dimes is a tremendous organization.
I can certainly sing their praises. As I mentioned, my twin Cena and Gunner, they are 14 now, and I can definitely sing the praises of the March of Dimes and Novant. That's where they were born. They spent the first 6 months of their life up there, and it is a heaven-sent team of nurses and doctors and everyone, the support staff up there. So they certainly have helped my children not only survive but thrive, which is my thing I always like to say about the March of Dimes and how it helps kids. People might not be aware that November is Prematurity Awareness Month. The 17th is World Prematurity Awareness Day. And Jamie, can you tell us a little bit about how common is premature birth? I don't think people really realize how many babies are born premature every year.
Right. So here in the Carolinas, about 1 in every 9 baby is premature. So wow. it's a startling number when you think about it in the grand scheme of 500,000 births that might be happening. I mean, that's no math major, but that's a pretty large number. So yeah, it's very common. And that's something that we're working to figure out why it's happening and then to resolve that issue.
What are some of the main developments that the March of Dimes has come up with over years with all the research and things they're doing? And what are some of the things that they've come up with to help premature babies that have survived and to help them thrive and to even just survive their premature birth?
I'm going to toss this one to Pat because I feel like okay. this has some medical stuff that I might not be too keen on.
Yeah, I mean, one of the biggest things, obviously, is surfactant. you know, which helps out with the lungs as those premature babies. That's one of the major problems, is the fact that, you know, their lungs are so premature and they just cannot breathe and that type of thing on their own. So the surfactant helps tremendously and helps, you know, after that initial period, you know, as well. So that definitely is a big piece of the prematurity. But I would also say, you know, just looking at the impact of prenatal care and thinking about the social determinants of health and the impact of pregnancy there. And look, the March of Dimes has done a lot of research in those arenas to say, okay, and that was really, I think, one of the things that the supportive pregnancy was born out of, is to say, how do we get pregnant women in for prenatal care? And so if you've got them in this group setting where they're in with, you know, individuals of lack of, or individuals that are like them, that are issues that an individual is facing, it gives more motivation to participate in the overall care. So, again, to me, it's the research, it's the therapeutics of medications that the March of Dimes is a big, big advocate for, but it's also thinking about those innovative programs of how do you get moms and families to participate. The other thing I would say is being an advocate for moms and babies at the legislative level, whether that be, you know, federal, state, regional, the March of Dimes is there. When there's a policy that relates to the health of moms and babies, they're there to support and to add what are the important factors of that legislation to move forward.
Well, you were telling us, Jamie, that it's 1 in 9 babies in North Carolina born premature. Pat, can you tell us, like, what does that mean when you're born premature? I mean, I know some babies might just be a few weeks early, some like mine, you know, 3.5 months early. What does it look like in a premature baby, ranging from the earliest ones that can survive, you know, to ones that maybe are just born a few weeks too soon?
Sure. And I'll start with kind of those that are born at a real early gestational age. You know, when you're talking 23, 24 weeks of gestation, those are the critically ill babies. You know, you're talking a pound or less in terms of birth weight. And you can really, you know, think the lungs, we've mentioned that, but pretty much every body organ is not developed. So then you have to think multi-system issues with those babies, and the providers and the whole healthcare team do an amazing job to really develop a plan of care for that baby. If, you know, if the baby, and those real early babies usually are on a ventilator, you know, being mechanically supported, just a lot of medications. You think about the feeding issues. They obviously can't, you know, be fed by mouth. So you've got to weigh in all of those things, and what can the baby tolerate, and, you know, how are all of the organs doing? And, you know, so that's all the physical part. But then also you think about what these parents are dealing with, and, you know, other extended family, and seeing a baby go through all of this and seeing them in an intensive care unit. So you really have to think about, how do we support them? You know, how do we be sure that we're letting them know what's going on with the baby? What are the odds of things, you know, improving, or unfortunately maybe not improving, and, you know, providing whatever assistance that they may need? So, you know, I can speak at Novant Health. We have a wonderful social worker department that really adds a lot of support, chaplain's office, many, many others that, again, come together to make that team to help help the parents and family members. For babies that, you know, are more toward term and do not have a lot of other underlying conditions, you know, you're not talking about an extensive care period, hopefully, in the NICU, but it's still stressful. So you still have to be sure. And again, I think our healthcare team and other healthcare teams everywhere do a great job now with really involving the parents, involving individuals, you know, and letting them know what is going on as much as you can. Frequently. And of course, you know, again, I'll go back to COVID. How do you do this in a COVID environment when you're limiting, you know, the visitors and limiting the family? And I will tell you, we've used a lot of, you know, platforms with the FaceTime and, you know, other iPads, everything. So, we've really tried to be conscious of that because it's so important to be sure that families are kept up to date with what's happening.
Have there been any instances of premature babies contracting COVID that you're aware of?
Not that I'm aware of within our organization. Now, the other thing that we do is constantly look at the literature that's out there. And, you know, across the nation and across the world, actually, there have been some cases, but not as many, fortunately, as you may think would happen. So we, you know, we also closely monitor moms coming into labor, testing them and that type of thing. And fortunately, we haven't seen huge numbers, but it does exist with COVID.
I know that I certainly wasn't planning on having premature children. I had mine as a result of an accident. But do we know why most babies are born premature?
Unfortunately, we don't know the answer to that. And again, I have high hopes that the March of Dimes is really going to aid to continue. I know they're going to continue in that research to try to help find that answer along with many others. You know, there's some things out there that may contribute, but in terms of an exact cause of prematurity, we don't know.
Wow. That is what obviously makes the work of the March of Dimes so important. And one of the big events coming up is the Chef's event here in the Charlotte Greater Hickory area. And this is one of the main fundraisers of the March of Dimes here locally that helps raise the funds to try to find out, to fund this research to find out why babies are born premature and to help them and their family. So I know this one's going to look a little different than it has in years past. So Jamie, can you tell us a little bit about the Chef's event, when it's happening and what's going to be happening this year?
Sure. So yes, it definitely is going to look a little different. If you've been to our event before, it's a very fun, exciting event that normally brings in about $300,000. And this year we could not do that because of COVID. So what we've done is we've opted to go virtual. And with that virtual component, we have still been able to engage our signature chefs. So what we've done is we've partnered with seven chefs in the Charlotte area who have created these three-course meals that are absolutely incredible, and guests have the option of purchasing these meals to enjoy event night. So we really encourage people to check out our website and to go order those tickets. This is also going to be a free event for those who don't want to purchase the meals. So we want to get as many eyes on this event as possible. We have a wonderful live auction. We have an amazing silent auction. We have a wonderful raffle item from our partners over at Morris & Smith who work with us every year, and they're just delightful. And then we also have our Fund the Mission campaign, which is where people can donate directly to support March of Dimes' mission.
Now, I know that I've been to this event many times, and it's always a lot of fun because you get to sample, I mean, some of the best cuisine in the Charlotte area and go around to the different tables. Like you said, you can't do that this year because of COVID, but you're still bringing that experience to people who want to go out there and try this. So can you tell us who are some of the chefs and what kind of meals that people can purchase?
Sure. So we have 7 amazing restaurants who are involved with us this year. They've partnered with us in the past, so we're so excited that they continue to be with us. So we have The Bistro, which is in Concord, who they're creating this wonderful steak meal, and they also have a French airline chicken breast that they're creating, which sounds amazing. We have Fin and Fino, Forchetta. We have Oak Steakhouse, Pump House down in Rock Hill. We have Salt Chef Events. And then we also have Sea Level, who has a really great, we have a fresh catch and then a fried catfish option. So each restaurant has prepared 2 options for folks to choose from. So I'm sure everyone can find something that they like.
How exactly is it going to work? I mean, do you order online? Do you go pick up your food? Or how does, give us the exact details on how people can participate.
Sure. So folks will go to our website, which is event.gives/NCMOD. Okay. And there you can see our full menu. We also have partnered with Tito's, who will be giving out cocktail kits with every meal that's purchased, which is awesome.
Okay.
People will go, they'll select their restaurant, and then they'll select the time that they want to pick up their food. And then so event pickup is on the 21st between 4 and 6 p.m. So we'll have March of Dimes representatives at each restaurant to help check out the folks and come get their food, hand them their Tito's, and encourage them to go watch the program.
Okay, gotcha. Now, for the actual event itself, this is going to be an online, but it's going to be a live event, right? Tell us a little bit about the program.
Correct. So we have a wonderful auctioneer that we've partnered with this year. So we have a live interactive platform that we're using. So people will be able to bid in real time for our live auction. They will also, we'll open up silent auction before, so they'll be able to bid through that week before the event, make sure that they get all the things that they want. And then when the program starts, they'll be ready to go. So yeah, you can bid on something. The auctioneer can see your name, shout you out.
Oh, wow.
Thanks, Sharon, so much for making a donation and keep folks engaged, which is really great.
Yeah, it sounds like it's going to be a really fun event. Now, I know that this is, like you said, it's been a huge fundraiser in the past. So COVID-19 is messing everybody up, needless to say. But Pat, how important is it, in your opinion, that people still stay engaged and still participate in this to help fund the March of Dimes and what they do?
Great question. And the answer is we have not found the answer to stop and prevent prematurity. And we are still seeing moms and babies that not only need hospitalization, but need care in general. And we need to be able to support the March of Dimes for future research. I mean, just like COVID, this is something that happened to us, you know, to our country, to the world this year. We don't have an answer for it, not even a vaccine. So the work of the March of Dimes, in summary, is not going to go away, unfortunately. And we have got to continue, I would say even more so now, supporting this great organization to be able to continue to make a difference. So I would encourage everyone to participate with us, particularly this year in 2020, with what we are seeing facing this world in terms of health.
Absolutely. Well, the March of Dimes is doing wonderful things to help moms and premature babies and to prevent premature birth. As I mentioned, this month, November, is Prematurity Awareness Month, World Prematurity Day, coming up on November 17th. I encourage everybody to wear your purple on that day to support the March of Dimes and help bring awareness to premature birth. So we've been speaking with Pat Campbell. She is the Vice President of the Women's and Children's Institute at Novant Health here in Charlotte. She's also the Chair of the Greater Charlotte Hickory Division of the March of Dimes. Also, Jamie Gensheimer has joined us. She's the Development Manager for the Greater Charlotte Hickory Area March of Dimes. And we've been talking a lot about premature birth and what the March of Dimes does, and also about this really exciting event coming up on November 21st, the Signature Chef's Auction, which is always a lot of fun. And it sounds like it's going to be great this year as well, just coming across in a different format. So we encourage everybody to go out and sign up to be a part of that awesome event. I know I will be there, and it should be a lot of fun. So thank you both, Jamie and Pat, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stay tuned, everyone. We've got a lot more coming up this morning on Carolina Focus.
WBT, a radio.com station.
And welcome back to Carolina Focus. Carolina Focus is being heard on News Talk 1110, 99.3 WBT, 107.9 Alink, and 102.5 610 Sports Radio FNC, all Intercom Charlotte. I'm Ed Billick, along with Sharon Thorsland. And earlier in the week, Atrium Health held a special news conference on Veterans Day. It featured Dr. James Rachel, a psychiatrist with Atrium Health. He's also an Air Force veteran, and he discusses the rates of mental health illness among COVID-19 survivors, as well as mental health issues among veterans. Timely and appropriate. This is Atrium Health right here on Carolina Focus.
A study came out yesterday about COVID-19 survivors and the rates of mental illness among them within 90 days of their diagnosis of the virus. So we want to make sure that we touch on both of these topics. So what I'll do is go ahead and toss it off to Dr. James Rachel. And again, he's a psychiatrist with Atrium Health. He's also our medical director of Atrium Health Behavioral Health Charlotte facility. And he's a veteran himself. He's also a COVID-19 survivor. So he can talk to both of these topics from a personal and professional point of view. So, Dr. Rachel, if you could start by maybe 5 minutes talking about veterans' mental health, and then spend another maybe 5 minutes about the new study that came out about COVID-19 survivors.
So when we're thinking about veterans' mental health, we know a couple things. We know that they're much more likely to suffer stress disorder than the average civilian. Those that were in Operation Iraqi Freedom, about 20%, up to 20% of those people that have returned from OIF have some form of post-traumatic stress disorder. And we're thinking about Vietnam, it's even higher at 30%. And that's compared to about 7 to 8% of civilians. Also, when we're thinking about veterans, the other thing we know, unfortunately, is the suicide rates are much higher with veterans. In fact, a veteran is 1.5 times more likely to die by suicide than a civilian. And that's for a variety of things. Part of it is, in fact, because they're more likely to be traumatized and suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. But we also know veterans also have a higher risk of depression and anxiety as well. The positive thing is that we know veterans actually are fairly likely to seek care. In fact, about 50% of the veterans that have symptoms of depression or anxiety are likely to seek care. But that means another 50% or half of those people do not seek care. And so they are.
You mentioned that this is Sarah Blake with the Associated Press, Doctor. You mentioned that the rate of veterans seeking help is usually pretty high and pretty successful. Have you seen those numbers go up, though? I mean, has that always been the case?
I think a lot. I mean, I would say it's higher than the civilian population. I wouldn't say it's as many as need to seek care. I don't think those numbers really have changed that much as far as over time, as far as who seek care, who's not. I know that suicide risks have increased over time.
It's also worth noting that suicide rates in general among all people have increased. So it's not a surprise that we're seeing an increase among veterans as well. Any further questions about veteran mental health?
I'll just ask one more. From your perspective, what are we missing? What needs to be done to improve these numbers?
I think a lot of it comes down to stigma, and that's really common across the board. I know in the military, there certainly was some stigma around seeking mental health, but also in some ways, I sometimes found commanders more likely to send somebody to behavioral health than out in the civilian world. So I think really when we're thinking about what is the greatest thing that keeps people from seeking behavioral health care when they need it, or mental health care when they need it, it really is the stigma that surrounds it. People don't want to walk into the clinic. Sometimes that can be somewhat anxiety provoking. Certainly, depending, it can be a cost issue too for some people. And honestly, a lot of people just don't want to see themselves as sick. Or needing help, and not even sick, but just simply needing help. And so a lot of times those serve as barriers to people seeking care.
All right, we'll go ahead and move on to the next topic of that study that came out about mental illness among COVID-19 survivors. So Dr. Rochelle, I'll go ahead and discuss that for a few moments and then we'll dive into more questions.
Yeah, that was a pretty eye-opening study that came out looking at the higher rates of depression, anxiety, as well as increased dementia on patients that survived COVID-19. I can speak to, in general, we're seeing more people, whether they have COVID-19 or not, coming in with anxiety and depression. The numbers are pretty startling. 31% of people during between April and June had reported anxiety and depressive symptoms. This was compared to 8.1% before. These are all comers. These are not people necessarily that had COVID-19. So as you can see, in general, COVID-19 has impacted people's behavioral health in general. 26% of people reported trauma and stress around COVID-19. We also saw a significant increase in substance use, and perhaps probably the most concerning thing we saw was an increase in suicidal thinking, going up to 11% of people having thoughts of suicide compared to 4.3% during that same time of the year in 2019. So we've seen a lot of symptoms just in general. Speaking about COVID-19 and the fact that survivors seem to be at higher risk for depression, anxiety, as well as cognitive issues, according to that study, there's multiple reasons for that. First of all, just in general, we're seeing, like I reviewed, we're seeing an increase in stress and anxiety symptoms and depressive symptoms among everybody. But certainly COVID-19, it has two effects on people. First of all, it's got an effect of isolating people, and I'll talk about that in a second. And we also believe it's having some neurologic consequences as well. So we're not sure, is the depression and anxiety being driven by neurologic consequences, or is it being driven by kind of this isolation and trauma that's associated with COVID-19? So I can speak from my own experience with COVID-19. When I got sick, I was the only person in my family that was sick. What that meant was I had to be isolated from everybody else. So I spent 2 weeks essentially with no contact other than what I could see through people through a window essentially. But I, as far as being able to touch anybody or be close to anybody, that was simply something that you can't do if you're trying to keep other people from becoming ill. So it's very, very isolating when that happens. And we know that isolation can increase anxiety. It can increase depressive symptoms. And so it has that effect on people. The other thing with COVID-19 is, quite honestly, it can also be difficult to breathe. I know in my case, I had some bronchospasms, which were unsettling and certainly caused some shortness of breath. That alone, we know that shortness of breath can increase anxiety in people because physiologically, your body, when it notices it's short of breath, that brings on anxiety. So then you couple with that, fortunately, I never had to go to the hospital. I never was in the ICU, and I never was on a ventilator. That's a whole different set of trauma for people. Again, you're in the hospital setting. We know that can be somewhat trauma provoking, and certainly when people are being on ventilators, that can be very traumatic for some people. Plus, being in a hospital, again, you're more isolated. You're further away from people. And quite honestly, when you're in a hospital with COVID-19, there's also going to be concerns about your health and your safety, and quite honestly, are you going to survive? And that also can be traumatizing to people. All of those things lead up to anxiety and depression. So you've got all of these, all this isolation and all this trauma that's associated with COVID-19, which alone can cause behavioral health issues. But then we also know that some people can become hypoxic with COVID-19, which again, that can lead to neurologic consequences. If you're hypoxic, it can affect your brain. We know there's an encephalopathy that can be associated with COVID-19, and that means simply that it's a disease of your brain. And so that can affect depression, anxiety, and your cognitive abilities, or lead to some forms of dementia. So that also is impacting things. We also know there's a risk of stroke associated with COVID-19. Again, that can lead to diminished cognitive abilities, and also depending on where the stroke is, it could have emotional consequences as well. So there is a large variety of reasons why people can be adversely affected by COVID-19, and why it can lead to these both anxiety, depression, and dementia.
Have you seen or treated any COVID patients with mental illness? And if not, what are you seeing? I know you just touched on isolation, trauma, and anxiety, but what are you hearing from other people who have contracted the virus, especially if it was a more serious case of it as compared to yours?
Yeah, so I haven't personally treated anybody with COVID-19 as far as from a mental health standpoint. I have treated people that have had significant effects from COVID-19. And a lot of that has to do around the isolation, that where we've told people that they need to stay in at home and decrease their social interactions. And so I am seeing a lot of my patients are struggling with not being able to do a lot of things that they were doing before, especially in their routine, whether they're not able to go to work than they were before, or go to some sort of recreational activities. That's really been impacting a lot of my patients, actually in some cases resulting in some suicidal thinking and hospitalization. So that's been significant there. Talking with other people that have been ill with COVID-19, obviously there's a variety of experiences for people. I know some people have lost sense of smell and taste. That's obviously been pretty disconcerting for them, especially not knowing when or if they're going to get that back, can be pretty anxiety provoking for them. I know a lot of people have experienced once COVID-19 has improved, this has gone away, but have kind of discussed some difficulty with thinking and processing when they've been sick with COVID-19, although those effects, at least to the people I've spoken with, seem to have resolved. So those are the major issues I've experienced or I've encountered. But again, there's a wide variety, and my expectation is I will be seeing more and more people that have had COVID-19 that will later come in with depression and anxiety and other things that are associated with that, with actually having COVID-19. It's just, even though it's been with us for 6 months now, from a behavioral health standpoint, we generally see things, this is about the time we start seeing patients that have difficulty with the disease process. That's when we start seeing them. It's about 6 to 8 months down the road a lot of time, which is probably the reason why we're seeing this paper come out now.
Got it. And as far as, you know, a physical symptom leading to a mental health issue or symptom, I know you mentioned, or the study mentions dementia and how, you know, dementia could come out of a COVID-19 diagnosis, and you're not oxygenating properly, which can affect your brain. Can you talk about that a little bit? I think you expressed to me that you weren't surprised to see that in this study.
Right, and there's a variety. And again, we don't really understand how COVID-19 exactly affects the brain. It could be having some sort of physiologic impact on the brain that we don't completely understand right now, which could be leading to dementia. So there's a variety of reasons why people could be we could be seeing an increase in dementia afterwards. But the other issue is obviously if you're not oxygenating your brain or you're hypoxic, that could result in injury to your brain, and part of the reason why we're seeing some of these issues. But again, it certainly wasn't spelled out in the paper that was one of the reasons, and it's hard for me to say whether it is or is not. The other thing, honestly, too, is again we're seeing a hypercoagulability state with COVID-19. I know there's been reports of people having strokes, even young people. And again, that can also lead to cognitive decline.
Also, people who maybe didn't contract COVID-19, but are just impacted by the pandemic from, you know, another point of view of, you know, being isolated, having to work remote, being at home a lot alone. So there are other people aside from survivors who are also impacted mentally by the pandemic.
Right. And those are the numbers I talked about where we're seeing a 31% report of anxiety and depression in our population versus an 8.1% of anxiety and depression at the same time last year without COVID-19. So there is a large increase of anxiety and depressive symptoms being reported. And we're also seeing an increase in suicidal thinking. Again, you're looking at 11%. Some studies now versus 4.3% before. So there's definitely an increase in behavioral health concerns across the board, not just people affected by COVID-19. Not just people that are actually infected with COVID-19. I think we're all affected by COVID-19, but obviously the group that's been infected is much smaller, fortunately.
Anything else you want to clarify, Dr. Rochelle, for the group, or just reiterate as something that stands out to you on either topics?
One thing I'd reiterate from the veteran mental health standpoint is that this is a group of people that have given a lot to their country, and so it's really important that now that when they are in need, that we find a way to help them with whatever their medical needs are, whether they be behavioral health or any other medical issue. And then with COVID-19, I would just say that obviously there's been a significant behavioral health impact across the board with COVID-19, but we certainly are seeing an even greater impact with those that have been infected by it.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time. If anybody has follow-up questions, please contact me. Thanks again.
And up next, from our sister station WCCO, this is a discussion with Dr. Michael Osterholm, who's being named to Joe Biden's Coronavirus Task Force. This is exclusive audio, some great discussion right here on Carolina Focus.
Let's go to the CenterPoint Energy Home Service Plus hotline this morning on WCCO 721. Dr. Michael Osterholm, as you know, is an epidemiologist, also a Regents professor and author at Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy. He's the director over there at the University of Minnesota. Mike, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, David. Good. Thank you.
There's a lot of news breaking this morning. One of those would be my first question to Dr. Osterholm. Well, are you going to be a member of President-elect Joe Biden's newly named Coronavirus Task Force?
I am a member and look forward to working however I can to help advise him or anyone at the federal government level on what we can do to address this this pandemic.
Do you know some of your peers on that list, Mike?
I do. I do. Actually, I know them all. So it's a group of individuals I know are highly committed to doing whatever they can to help. You know, this is truly a science-rich, nonpartisan group that is just there to deal with the pandemic. As you and I have been talking, you know, we have some really tough days ahead of us. These next 2 to 3 months are going to be by far the darkest of the pandemic. And you can see right here in Minnesota, I mean, 6,000 cases yesterday reported. You know, just 2 months ago, people would have felt that 1,000 to 2,000 cases was, you know, just an incredibly high number. And that 6,000 number is just where we're starting from. It's going to get much higher. So I think people can understand we're in a tough spot. This is where we need people. Please understand, protect yourself, you know, save your life and that of a loved one. Please don't be in big crowds. You know, don't go and put yourself in harm's way right now. This is real. This situation is real. Right now, we are virtually overrun in our intensive care units in this state. This is real.
Worldwide, what's the status this morning?
The whole world is a challenge right now, but in one regard, you know, Europe clearly is a problem. A number of low-income countries, but at the same time, Asia is really in quite good shape. If you look from New Zealand to Australia all the way up to Japan, China, You know, they've done it. They have given us the blueprint to say, how can we not have to suffer all these cases? And it was basically driving the case numbers down through distancing. And then once you get them to a low number, do the test and tracing and the contact follow-up, you know, making sure that we really capture all these cases. And right now in many of these countries, life is moving on quite normal. Their economies are gaining. And so, you know, we don't have to be like this. We just don't have to be. It's our own decision in the way if we elect to neglect responding to this virus, then the virus will find us. And that's what's happening. Whereas in Asia, you know, they're doing an incredible job at keeping case numbers very, very low.
The folks at Pfizer are making news this morning, as you know as well, Dr. Osterholm, regarding this vaccine. Can you give us the details on that and what we should know?
Well, I wish I could. None of us can give details because they've not released anything except for a press release that does not at all tell us about just what they actually accomplished. And what I mean by that is they're, you know, surely demonstrating that they have protected people from a COVID-19 disease or infection. But what they haven't done is said what percentage of those were just mild illnesses and what percentage of those were severe illnesses. You know, we know from the influenza world that, in fact, you know, how well the vaccine works in part depends on certain underlying risk factors, such as if you have higher body mass indexes, you have other underlying diseases. And the very people that we need to protect the most with influenza from having serious outcomes are the people who often respond the least to the vaccine. So, you know, we're hopeful that the Pfizer data for coronavirus will say, you know, we prevented 90% of severe infections, hospitalization, deaths. And if we don't have that number there, then, you know, preventing 90% of muscle ache, fever, and chills is a very different kind of outcome. So it's really too early to put any kind of definition to what this new vaccine research shows us. I mean, thankfully, we have data that says, yes, we at least prevent some kind of illnesses without knowing what they are. But we won't really understand the real impact of the vaccine until we have more data. And we're hoping that gets forthcoming soon.
It was interesting this past weekend. I heard the health commissioner on the news, Commissioner Malcolm, talking about we can do all the lockdowns that we want, but basically comes down to us as individuals. Would you agree with that?
It really is. And it's, you know, it's about protecting our families. You know, you and I have discussed this right here on this show. You know, I have obviously not been popular by discouraging Thanksgiving Day get-togethers, Christmas holidays, planning for that. You know, I have personally been involved with far too many situations where a young, healthy adult comes home to see mom and dad or grandpa and grandma or Uncle Bill and Aunt Jane and unknowingly brings the virus home. And 3 weeks later, one or more of those family members are dead. And we've seen that happen over and over and over again. So, you know, this is our COVID year. We're just trying to get through till we get vaccines and hopefully get us back to what it was like last year. Don't expect this year to be the same way. So I hope families, for example, are really thinking seriously about holiday plans, about bringing people all back together, knowing that the one outcome that they most fear would be to have a transmission in the house, which bringing a group of people together, eating meals, talking, all the things we love about the holidays, the things that, you know, mean so much to us, are the very same things that end up transmitting this virus. So feel empowered this year to say no, not because you're being difficult, but because you love your family. And I think that's going to be a challenge for a lot of families. Is I worry about that. But I think that's going to be something that we can in our own power deal with. We can actually reduce the chance of having that and feel empowered to stand up and say, I'm not going to put my loved ones at risk.
Dr. Osterholm, I look forward to talking to you Wednesday again. Have a good week.
Thank you, David.
We'll see you a little.
Have a good one and stay safe yourself.
Thanks, Mike. Dr. Mike Osterholm here from the University of Minnesota, director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy, and now a member of the newly named Coronavirus Task Force.
Great discussion there. And hey, to wrap up our show this week, Bo Thompson spoke with Congressman Greg Murphy. You guys know he's both a congressman and a physician. He talks the COVID-19 vaccine and possibilities there, and the Biden transition team right here on Carolina Focus.
Want to bring on the WBT hotline right now. He just won re-election 1 week ago tonight. So congratulations to our next guest. He is Congressman Greg Murphy from District Number 3 in Eastern North Carolina. Congressman, good morning to you.
Good morning, Bo. I hope you're well.
I'm doing well. Hope you are. And as listeners know to this show, over the last year or so during this COVID-19 pandemic, I've brought you on a number of times because you offer that kind of dual perspective of being a congressman, but also being a physician. And so we had news yesterday about this Pfizer vaccine that, a week after the election is over, now we have news from the government that this thing is sounds like it's on the fast track. Now, I'm curious, on its face, the news about the vaccine and being 90% effective and what Pfizer had to say, your medical perspective and also your political perspective.
Well, I'll say that the timing, in my opinion, is a little suspect, but we can talk about that later. And from a vaccine standpoint, if a vaccine is 70% effective, that's good. But for a vaccine to be 90% effective is nothing short of spectacular. And this is what, you know, we have hoped. This is what the early studies had shown. And so I think that, Pfizer's vaccine are two shots, 3 weeks apart, and they've shown when compared to placebo that 90% of the people who got the vaccine were protected compared to those that got the placebo shot. So I think this is very, very good news. It's something called an RNA vaccine, and so it sends a messenger into the body's cells to make a protein that is similar to the virus, and the body react to that by creating antibodies so that when the virus does show up, the body's immune system is already primed and ready to attack it to decrease the effects of the virus itself. So I think this is very, very encouraging news.
Now, encouraging news, how quickly do you believe this can be implemented? I mean, it's one thing to have a vaccine that's 90% effective. It's another thing to, as you know, then distribute that and get it to the people. And how realistically are we talking having this into the mainstream?
Well, this is what the Department of Defense, the CDC, the FDA have been working on, you know, as part of Operation Warp Speed for the last 6 months to have this implemented. And, you know, and some people, the naysayers, are saying, well, Pfizer wasn't part of Operation Warp Speed. Pfizer did not take the money for the development, but they did take the money to say that the government will buy the vaccine. And so I think putting out millions of doses really – I think we're going to be able to distribute a large amount of this through the month of January and the next few months. The first amounts will go to those who are in healthcare, those who are at the highest susceptible conditions or positions, rather, and then out to the general public. You know, our biggest thing is going to be fighting the people, the anti-vaxxers who are not going to take it otherwise, but also people like New York Governor Cuomo, who is, in my opinion, risking people's lives by attacking the vaccine and its efforts. So it's not going to be perfect. We're not going to have 300 million doses on January 1st. But as the winter months conclude, I think the vast amount of our population should have access to the vaccine.
Talking to Greg Murphy, Dr. Greg Murphy, Congressman Greg Murphy, District Number 3 in North Carolina. So you're doing exactly when you come on, this is what I love, because we can talk about the medical side of this, but I now want to talk about the political side of this, because as you pointed out and we alluded to, the timing of this is interesting, to say the least. I mean, yesterday you saw the markets go crazy. You're seeing the cruise lines have all kinds of optimism again. You're seeing companies like Zoom that have been prevalent during the lockdown. Now all of a sudden their fortunes are pointed in the other direction. So the markets are taking note. The medical field is unveiling the information. Now, the political impact of this, in your eyes, is what now? Well, let's talk about that timing first.
Well, the timing, in my opinion, is suspect. I think they had this data 2+ weeks ago to be able to get this out. And so I'm very suspect about the timing. But, you know, I don't have any documents. I'm sure they'll come out for sure at some point that prove that. But it just isn't, in my mind, very, very suspect. What this does is what Joe Biden wanted. He basically, with the election, and who knows what the election really means, because of so much, you know, Pennsylvania, they got pulled back their electoral votes last night. Biden's going to swoop in and then take credit for all of this, which is just, you know, which is just utter nonsense. The president's administration has been going 24/7 at 200 miles an hour to try to create these vaccines, to try to get a infrastructure in place, and then Biden's going to swoop in and take credit for it.
Well, and that leads me to my next question. What do you think about Joe Biden going out and, holding these president-elect news conferences, and B, for example, yesterday, already naming his own task force? I mean, it's his right to do that once this thing becomes official, but I think it does raise some eyebrows that he's doing it so quickly, especially when President Trump has not maybe, and who knows how long it will be before he actually does, but at least, I mean, we're 1 week out now, and already, you know, an alternate task force has been set up as of yesterday.
Well, I, you know, and the saying in the world is perception becomes reality. He's pushing a perception to try to say, yes, I am the president-elect, when the election has not yet been certified. It's not even certified in North Carolina. And so I just think that's markedly premature. One of the fellows who's heading the task force, as I understand, is a person that says has put out a paper, a position that people really shouldn't live past 75. That's a little bit questionable. So, you know, it will be an interesting next couple of weeks because just on the political side, I've been on several phone calls about some of the fraudulent activities, alleged fraudulent activities in elections across the nation. So I guess stay tuned is the best thing.
Dr. Murphy, always appreciate your insight because, like I said, it comes from several different skews on this. Congressman, great. Thank you for your time as always, sir. Have a great day.
All right. God bless y'all. Thank you.
Monday, it's a new episode of All Rise, the legal drama where one judge is shaking up the system.
When I take the bench, I'm taking a vow to fight for justice.
One case at a time.
Your Honor,
we're going to trial.
Simone Missick is Judge Lola Carmichael.
Up on that bench, everything is different.
A new episode of All Rise.
Freedom is at stake.
It's important.
Followed by a new episode of Bull, Monday at 9, 8 Central on CBS.
Hackers are after your business data. I can help. I am Vi, the virtual intelligence assistant at Virtual Armor.
Virtual Armor, partnered with Juniper Networks, provides cybersecurity services and end-to-end solutions to keep what's yours, yours. Defend yourself with managed firewall and managed SIM essential core services that are economical and efficient. Virtual Armor goes beyond just initial alerting to provide a thorough report on threats, vulnerabilities, and results.
Let me help protect you. Contact me at justaskvi. That's vi.com.